So when you think of a time capsule, what usually comes to mind for you?
Probably something highly curated.
Right. A collection of pristine artifacts, carefully selected to show future generations our absolute best selves.
Like burying the shiny metals in the formal photographs.
Exactly. Today, it's basically the equivalent of an Instagram feed buried in a metal tube. We want to be remembered as having it all together.
It's the ultimate highlight reel. You bury the triumphs and conveniently leave out the messy, chaotic reality of, how you actually achieve them.
But the sources we are looking at for today's deep dive, they are like unearthing a time capsule that was never meant for public display.
Yeah, it's incredibly raw.
Unfiltered. It captures the profound right alongside the agonizingly mundane. Our mission today for you listening is we are exploring this fascinating stack of personal history. It's a retrospective life story and a daily journal spanning from 1979 to 1986, written by a woman named Helen Grubbs. And the goal of this deep dive is to unpack the reality of balancing identity, ambition, faith, and family.
And the beauty of these journals is just how thoroughly they shatter that idealized, pristine image of the mid-century homemaker. I mean, Helen's writings are a study in extremes.
They really are.
She documents battling cancer, having these transcendent spiritual revelations, and then literally on the very next page, she is agonizing over a spilled cup of juice.
Or hiding from her kids.
Right. Literally hiding from her six kids.
So to understand this intensely driven, totally overwhelmed mother writing those journals in 1979, we kind of have to look at the soil she grew in. We can't just start in
Why not
1979.
if you go back?
Yeah, because the circumstances surrounding her birth in 1947 are, well, they're genuinely unusual.
Very unusual. So she was born in Logan, Utah, into this generational gap that is honestly hard to wrap your head around. Her mother was 40 years old at the time,
Okay.
and her father, William, was 79.
Wait, 79 in 1947.
Yeah.
That means her father was born just a few years after the American Civil War.
Right. And sadly, he doesn't survive her infancy. When Helen is just 11 months old, William falls off an icy chicken coop and tragically dies from the complications.
Oh, wow. So she didn't even make it to her first birthday before her entire life was just upended,
Exactly.
which leaves her mother completely adrift. I mean, a single parent trying to survive in the late 1940s.
It was incredibly tough.
The journals detail her mother picking raspberries at dawn, working as a beautician, just, trying to keep the lights on. And Helen is constantly shuffled around. At one point, she's sent to live with her older sister June in Pocatello.
Where she's subjected to these rigidly strict naps.
Right. And she suffers through both scarlet and rheumatic fevers while she's there.
But that physical instability is really only the beginning. The major psychological shift happens when her mother marries a man named Matt Austin, and they relocate the family to a farm in Salmon, Idaho.
Okay, let me stop you there because I know what comes to mind for a lot of people when they hear mid-century Idaho farm.
Oh, sh
They picture this serene Norman Rockwell painting, right? Fresh pies cooling on a windowsill, feeding gentle calves in the morning sun. We tend to totally romanticize country childhoods.
Yeah, but there was absolutely nothing romantic about this environment.
Not at all.
The physical and emotional landscape was incredibly harsh. We're talking about a terrifying outdoor bathroom situated right next to a pig pasture.
Yikes.
And more profoundly, Helen is thrust into a blended family with step-siblings who actively resent her presence.
Yeah, they did not want a new mother, and they certainly didn't want a new little sister.
Exactly.
And the details she includes about those step-siblings are brutal. Her stepbrother Hiram used to spit in her mouth.
Okay.
And when they taught her how to do farm chores, they weren't teaching her how to gather eggs. They had her wringing the necks of baby sparrows.
Because the burrs were considered agricultural pests.
Right. But that isn't just a chore. That is a profound loss of innocence for a sensitive little girl who, already feels completely isolated.
I mean, put yourself in her shoes. How does a child survive in an environment that is that physically demanding and emotionally hostile?
You can't control the external world.
So you aggressively construct an internal one. Helen relies entirely on her imagination. She had this little phonograph and would play Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty records on a loop just to drown out the reality of the farm.
She genuinely convinced herself that fairies lived in the trees outside.
She built a psychological fortress out of music and fantasy.
But that level of internal control, it comes with a heavy price. There's this story she tells about being in kindergarten. She steals a classmate's jewelry.
Right, she takes it home.
She takes it home, hides it, and lies about it. But the guilt she feels isn't just standard childhood guilt. It is so utterly consuming that she takes the jewelry and throws it into a canal just to destroy the evidence of her failure.
And she still ends up having to confess and use her own allowance to buy a replacement. That isn't just a quaint story about a kid learning a lesson. It is the formation of a hypervigilant moral compass. When your survival depends on controlling your internal reality, you develop a rigid, punishing conscience. Every mistake feels catastrophic.
And that transition is what makes this so fascinating. That little girl, who learned to cope with chaos through sheer willpower, grows up. She becomes the mother of six that we meet in the 1979 journals.
And she is fiercely attempting to manifest this perfect, idealized vision of family and faith.
But she is constantly crashing into the exhausting, chaotic reality of domestic life. I mean, the journals from this period are a masterclass in cognitive dissonance.
They really are.
On one hand, you have her soaring spiritual aspirations. She is deeply, fundamentally devoted to the LDS or Mormon faith. She fasts regularly. She attends the temple.
And she writes with this profound, pure joy about the 1978 church revelation allowing black men to hold the priesthood. She's celebrating that they can now enjoy the same blessings.
Right. And it's important to look at her life purely as an artifact of its time, because her ideology permeated everything she did. She was heavily active in the political sphere of her faith as well.
Yeah, she was.
And just to impartially report the historical facts here for you listening, she wrote newspaper columns for a pro-family organization that actively opposed the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, regardless of where anyone stands on that politically today, reading her journal shows just how fiercely her political and religious ideals were tied to her personal identity. She wasn't just endorsing a policy. She was driven by an unwavering standard of what a mother and a woman should be.
And that ideology creates an impossible standard. She constantly writes about wanting to be a wise and humble servant. She wants a home filled with peace and order.
But the physical reality of raising six children does not care about your spiritual ideals.
No, it is the ultimate reality check. She writes about wanting to be this bastion of maternal grace. And then in the very next paragraph, she's admitting she completely lost her mind because her kid spilled 3 cups of orange juice on the floor.
3 cups.
Yeah. She writes about a son throwing a massive tantrum because he doesn't want to participate in a religious fast.
And on a stressful family road trip, she literally rates herself an 8/12 out of 10 for being the, quote, crab of the year.
The physical toll is staggering. She documents extreme fatigue, crippling pregnancy nausea, and just this deep desperation for control. When her environment feels chaotic, she reverts to that childhood coping mechanism, you know, controlling herself.
Like the diet.
Yes. At one point, she goes on a strict 1,200 calorie diet. And it's not necessarily for health, but just to feel like she has a firm handle on something, anything in her physical space.
There is one entry that I found so brutally honest. It's 1 a.m. Her toddler will not go to sleep, just flopping around the bed, screaming. And out of pure, blinding exhaustion, Helen slaps the child's rump just to shock her into stopping.
Which a lot of exhausted parents can probably relate to on some level.
Absolutely. But then she spends the rest of the entry dealing with the agonizing, crushing guilt of having lost her temper. And it makes you wonder, why do we do this to ourselves? Why do we judge our chaotic reality against a pristine ideal?
It's so common.
I couldn't help but think of modern momfluencers on social media.
Yeah.
You know, the ones with the beige houses, the perfectly curated outfits, the quiet children. Helen's journal is like the original, unfiltered, behind the scenes of that performance.
It reveals a fascinating paradox in her worldview, really.
Mm.
Her faith provides the impossible standard she repeatedly fails to meet. She actually writes at one point, she says, "I am sick of myself. I do not carry through with what I know."
Wow.
But simultaneously, that very same faith provides the mechanism of grace she uses to forgive herself. It's a constant churning cycle.
Uh-huh.
Strive for perfection, crash into reality, seek forgiveness, and then wake up the next day to try again.
And you would think the natural response to a toddler keeping you up until 1 a.m. and living in this constant cycle of exhaustion is to drop everything and sleep.
You'd hope so.
But Helen's psychological survival mechanism kicks in. She doesn't rest. She doubles down on creation. She pours herself into her immense musical talent.
Because music was her escape from the farm in Idaho, and it becomes her escape from the exhaustion of motherhood. But it isn't just a hobby. For Helen, it is a profound extension of her identity.
Yeah, she directs ward and regional choirs.
She arranges incredibly complex choral music for a massive four-state area conference.
Which involves what, like 400 singers?
Exactly, 400 singers. She's writing original music for stage plays like Cheaper by the Dozen. She even founds a massive community organization, the Young Naperville Singers.
And she writes about the high of this talent. She says that when she steps onto the director's podium, the messy house, the spilled juice, the fatigue, it all drops away. She feels she is fulfilling her life's mission.
It's exhilarating for her.
But I kept thinking of this metaphor while reading about her schedule. Having a massive talent is, well, it's kind of like taking in a hungry stray animal.
Okay, I like that.
It comes to your door, it gives you immense joy and a sense of companionship. But if you aren't careful about how much you feed it, it completely takes over your house.
Oh, that's a perfect way to look at it. A stray animal requires continuous feeding, and talent demands a massive caloric intake of your time and energy.
Yeah.
At first, she's just feeding it scraps,
yeah.
Right? A community choir here, a church arrangement there. But soon, she's arranging for hundreds of people across four states. The animal is consuming all her free time, leaving absolutely nothing left in the reserves for her or her family. It completely takes over Helen's house.
And she hits a terrifying breaking point. She confesses in her journal that the Young Naperville Singers has evolved into her creator that runs her life.
That's a strong word to use.
Very. She vividly describes a state of total creative and mental exhaustion. She writes that her barrel was empty, and she fantasizes about just abandoning all of it and hiding away with her family for the summer.
Which begs the question of why she doesn't just quit. If you are that burned out, if the barrel is empty, just step down from the podium. But psychologically, she is caught in a trap. In her religious framework, her musical talents are not just skills she developed. They were literal divine blessings given to her by God, specifically to build his kingdom on earth.
Oh, wow. So stepping back isn't just taking a break for her.
Exactly the opposite. To stop using those talents, or even to scale back, feels like a spiritual failure. It feels like she is actively rejecting a divine mandate. And that is why she is completely unable to simply rest.
She literally cannot stop feeding the stray animal because she believes God dropped it on her porch.
Precisely.
She's trapped between her physical limits and her spiritual obligations. But then, just as she is reaching this absolute breaking point with her self-imposed standards, the universe intervenes. Life throws genuine existential crises her way.
The kind of crises that force a radical, involuntary shift in perspective.
Yeah.
The first major shock is the sudden death of her stepfather, Matt Austin.
And that's the same stepfather she moved to Salmon, Idaho with, the man who brought her into that hostile farm environment.
The very same. But his death acts as a catalyst for something deeply unexpected. You know those step-siblings who were so awful to her as a child?
Yeah.
Her stepbrother Hiram comes to her in tears.
Wait, the Hiram who taught her to ring Sparonax? The one who spat in her mouth?
Yes. The primary villain of her childhood. He comes to her weeping and apologizes for how he treated her when they were growing up.
No way.
He tells her he was a terrible brother and that he wasted so much time. And just think about the psychological weight of that for Helen. A woman who built her entire adult identity on escaping the chaos and hostility of that farm is suddenly being handed closure by the person who caused her so much pain. Is a profound moment of healing.
But the universe doesn't give her a moment to catch her breath. I mean, the whiplash of these journals is intense. She is just 38 years old. She has just accepted a massive, demanding leadership calling as the Relief Society president for her church congregation.
And mere days later, she is diagnosed with breast cancer.
Everything stops.
The endless choir rehearsals, the political columns, the exhaustion over a messy house. She is suddenly staring directly at her own mortality.
And the journals during this period are heartbreaking, but not for the reason you might think. What really struck me is that she isn't actually afraid of death itself.
Right, she's not.
Her faith is so strong that she genuinely writes, she thinks passing on will be a marvelous experience. What utterly terrifies her, what makes her plead with God in these raw, agonized journal entries for more time, is the thought of leaving her six children motherless.
Yeah.
The pain of not being there to guide them through their own messy lives.
Facing death completely reframes everything we've read up to this point. When you are on your knees pleading for your life just so you can raise your children, the petty frustrations vanish. The spilled orange juice, the tantrums over fasting, the messy living room, they aren't burdens anymore.
They're evidence of life.
Exactly. They are the very things she is terrified of losing.
And she gets the miracle she prayed for. The surgery is successful. Her lymph nodes are completely clean. She survives.
But then?
Yeah, but then, almost immediately after recovering from cancer surgery, her husband, Bill, loses his job. I mean, talk about feeling targeted. It's like the universe looked at her and said, oh, you survived the childhood trauma, the burnout, and the cancer. Here's a side of sudden unemployment.
And 6 months of unemployment could easily break a family that has just been through a cancer battle.
Yeah.
But Helen's response is astonishing. This is where we see the final evolution of her character.
Right.
When Bill finally secures a new job in Nebraska, a job that requires them to uproot their lives and take a 20% pay cut, she doesn't view it as a stroke of bad luck or an unfair demotion. She views it as a direct divine blessing that could only come after enduring a necessary trial.
She writes this incredibly profound philosophical insight during this crucible. After a lifetime of trying to engineer perfection, she wonders if these agonizing trials, the cancer, the terror, the unemployment, the chaos, are actually the exact experiences necessary to forge her family into an eternal unit.
She finally accepts the pain, not as a punishment for failing to be a perfect mother, but as the fire required to bind them together forever.
Her ideals and her reality finally merge.
Yeah. The trials aren't signs that she isn't working hard enough.
Yeah.
They are the forge where resilience is built. She stops fighting the chaos and starts finding meaning within it.
Which brings us back to why Helen Grubbs' private journals matter to you listening right now. This stack of paper is so much more than an autobiography of a mid-century mother. It is a testament to the messy, contradictory, deeply beautiful process of just living.
We all have our own versions of spilled orange juice that make us lose our temper.
Oh, definitely. We all have unfulfilled ambitions, stray animals of talent we feed until they consume us, and sudden, terrifying life tests that drop us to our knees. Helen's life is proof that greatness isn't about perfection. It isn't about having a pristine, curated life. It's about showing up day after day.
It's about failing, forgiving yourself, and having the courage to try again tomorrow.
Exactly.
It is the ultimate realization that the mundane and the profound are inextricably linked. You cannot separate the spiritual highs from the physical exhaustion. They are simply two sides of the exact same human coin.
And that brings us back to the idea of the time capsule we talked about at the very beginning. I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over.
Okay, let's hear it.
Imagine if a stranger were to dig up your private journals, read your text messages, or observe your daily routines 50 years from now. Would they see the pristine, highly curated image you project to the world? Or would they see the beautiful, chaotic reality of someone desperately trying to do their best? Ask yourself what mundane details of your life today are actually the hidden building blocks of your legacy. Keep that in mind the next time the juice spills.